Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. If you're listening to this program, you probably know a little bit more about USAID than you did 3 weeks ago. It's been one of the poster children so far of the Trump administration's efforts to cut government spending and scale back aspects of the federal government. My guest today is an expert on the agency and on foreign aid more generally. Catherine Harold is a professor of public administration and international relations at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship, and she also spent a year in USAID as a fellow. Professor Harold, welcome to the program.
Grant, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we really appreciate you making the time. So this will be old hat to you, but let me just start for our listeners with some basics. As I just mentioned in the introduction, most listeners now probably have some familiarity with USAID, if they didn't already beforehand. But it's something that they probably don't know that much about. So it stands for the United States Agency for International Development, but tell us a little bit about the context of where it fits. I mean, let's start at the beginning. I mean, why was USAID created back in the Kennedy administration? What were they trying to do? And why is it separate from the State Department?
Well, Grant, I think of USAID, and I'm going to call it USAID. Some use the term USAID, some use the U.S. Agency for International Development. I just use USAID. Anything is correct. So I think of USAID as both an aid provider and a key pillar of U.S. foreign policy and national security. So let me start with the aid side. The USAID and the, well, so the United States is the largest donor of humanitarian assistance. And by humanitarian assistance, I mean responding to disasters, responding to human emergencies around the world. We are the single largest donor to the United Nations and to the world, providing about 40% of humanitarian assistance. Now, of the U.S. International aid that goes abroad, $45 billion of that is provided by by USAID. But what many of our listeners might not know is that $20 billion is provided by the State Department, and then $8 billion goes to military spending. So I think of aid in terms of development, right? The U.S. Agency for International Development, but also a key aspect of diplomacy. When the U.S. provides aid, this is a diplomatic tool. It's also a tool of defense, and I'm happy to talk more about those aspects. But I think it's just worth saying that in addition to humanitarian assistance and development assistance, those two constitute the bulk of USAID's giving. The agency also does a little bit of work on the democracy promotion side and a little bit of work in the environment, but really the bulk of aid is around helping people around the world.
Thanks. And so why is it separate? Why isn't all of it just part of the State Department? I know that some executive agencies that were created by different presidents or initiated by different presidents, they want them separate so they can keep their fingers on them a little bit more, that they're, you know, they take special interest in them. Is that what was going on with John F. Kennedy and USAID?
Well, so USAID is very closely related to the State Department. The agencies have joint strategies. USAID is very much aligned with state, and in fact, around the world, many, if not most, USAID missions are based in embassies, right? So they are right at the interagency table with state, with defense. But it's also important for the U.S., and Kennedy recognized this, to have a dedicated agency to providing care for the world's most marginalized communities. Now, I will say that it was also a tool of diplomacy and national security and national interests in the Cold War, but there's diplomacy, but there's also something about the soft power of aid. that really is a powerful indicator and tool of U.S. soft power.
So you mentioned a couple times now we've heard this also in recent weeks that the United States is the largest provider of this kind of aid in the world. But we've also heard a lot about China and China's foreign aid and infrastructure development through its Belt and Road Initiative. Does that rival U.S. aid? Is it something different? Should they not be seen as different types of the same thing? Help me understand that.
U.S. aid has traditionally been at the table in interagency discussions. And having a key seat at the table in U.S. interagency discussions about China, and specifically because of that Belt and Road Initiative. Now, the BRI dwarfs U.S. spending on foreign assistance, or USAID spending. They've invested hundreds of billions of dollars. I mentioned that USAID invested $45 billion in 1 year, but China is rivaling and surpassing the U.S. In terms of development, okay? So this is slightly different than U.S. aid. The Belt and Road Initiative is a series of infrastructure investments, but it looks a heck of a lot like development projects. The financing is quite different. The financing of the BRI tends to put recipient countries in more precarious financial situations, tying them to loans that may be difficult to pay back, tying them to using Chinese workers. So there is a distinction there, but I'll tell you one thing, if you're someone if you're a marginalized or vulnerable person in a vulnerable part of the world, and China is offering some fancy infrastructure projects, and the United States is saying, goodbye, we're pulling aid. I'll tell you one thing, that should be a major concern for U.S. foreign policy.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Catherine Harrell, a Syracuse University professor, and we've been discussing some of the issues surrounding U.S. aid and the Trump administration's actions regarding that. So one of the criticisms that I have heard and read of U.S. aid that we've heard from the administration is that some of the money, and you know, depending on who's speaking, it sounds like a lot of the money goes to fringy sounding DEI initiatives in other countries rather than helping them with their most fundamental material challenges. And some of the, you know, you get these sort of crazy sounding examples that get thrown around. Do you have any idea of the proportion of aid that we're talking about here that are devoted to these kinds of things?
It's minuscule. And first of all, I want to set the record straight that some of the projects that have been cited as woke have actually come from the State Department. So there's some misinformation circulating. Of USAID's budget, a tiny fraction goes to education and democracy. I've got the numbers somewhere. It's a tiny fraction. So 2% of USAID's budget goes to education, 3% to democracy, 14% peace and security, 23% health, 22% human services, and 27 economic development. So if we think of culture and education, this is a tiny, tiny portion of USAID's budget. And within that, USAID is funding very traditional arts and culture projects, for example. I will also say that USAID is one of the most risk-averse institutions that exists. It is very, very careful about what it funds. It does not fund abortions, as I think a rumor circulated. It does not fund terrorists. There's, in fact, a terrorism clause that if any organization that applies for USAID funding has any connection whatsoever to a person or group that the U.S. deems a terrorist, they cannot receive USAID funding. So I would say that rather than being this you know, woke DEI focused organization, USAID is risk averse and really projects, I would say, core American values that the average American really cares about.
So I want to get a sense of what the overall then strategy is for the aid, or at least what it was prior to Trump's inauguration. And what I'm hearing from you, let me say it back and then you comment on it if you would, is that it's, I'm going to compare it to China a little bit because you spoke about that. It's less explicitly strategic and self-interested, if you would, and more oriented toward helping other countries, but also doing it in a way that makes the United States look good and helps our relationships with countries around the world. Is that sort of the overall strategy? Did I capture that right? Would you add something to it?
That's absolutely right, Grant. And the year that I was at USAID, I was working on the team that was charged with developing and spreading through the agency a key strategy and policy of locally led development. Now, this was a key pillar of the first Trump administration's USAID strategy. That strategy under Administrator Mark Green was called the Journey to Self-Reliance. The U.S. was focused under the first Trump administration on supporting locally led development and humanitarian assistance projects throughout the world. So our listeners may not know this, less than 10% of USAID funding actually goes to local organizations in target countries. So for example, I do a lot of work in Serbia. Serbian NGOs or non-governmental organizations do receive some USAID funding, but the bulk of USAID funding goes to international NGOs, often that are headquartered in the United States, and also contracting agencies, American contracting agencies. So under Trump, and then even more so under former Administrator Samantha Power, who was the Biden administration's USAID administrator, there was a real push to get more money in the hands of local actors under the assumption that local people understand their needs, their priorities, their challenges, and are best situated to use aid effectively to address those needs, priorities, and challenges. Whereas China's model is more imposing China's own version of development, the U.S. has really been, under multiple administrations, focused on supporting local actors, again, with a very important focus on managing risk.
Yeah, I know you've done some research on that's led to different ways of thinking about what are the best ways for us to conduct this aid. And I want to get to that a little bit later in the conversation. Take a break for now. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship professor, Catherine Harold. And we've been discussing the issues that have been raised by the Trump administration's actions regarding USAID and its early rounds of executive orders. So this approach so far by the administration has been pretty wholesale toward the things that it has targeted. That aid is being paused, staff being put on leave. There are indications based on what we hear from Elon Musk and the president and some other actors that USAID as a government entity may be scrapped. Let me just start with a big one. If that were the case, how damaging would that be to the nations that are actually getting our aid?
It would be hugely damaging to lives around the world. First, as I said earlier, the lives of the world's most marginalized and vulnerable populations will be at stake. In addition, the lives of countless staff members of organizations that receive USAID to deliver programs, to deliver projects, to deliver food, shelter, healthcare. They will lose their jobs. Many already have. American families will also be affected, both those who live in the United States and work for USAID at the Ronald Reagan Building, or previously did. Many of my colleagues, my former colleagues from USAID, they're out of jobs right now. And families, American families who are stationed around the world, often working in very, very dangerous places, their livelihoods are at stake as well. Not only financially, but their careers are upended. And these Foreign Service officers care deeply, deeply about the marginalized and vulnerable people that they serve. So this is really going to wreak havoc among families everywhere.
And let's be selfish for a moment and just think about the United States. But you spoke to this in terms of the folks that work there and also receive money but are based here. But let's think about the United States interests. Is this being penny wise and pound foolish when it comes to advancing U.S. interests? Is it, would you say?
Absolutely. And I would say I'd like to speak to the U.S. reputation and also our national security. So on the reputational side, right, our allies and even those who we hope to be allies, right, countries whose alliances we care about, they will lose trust. They are already losing trust in America. So our reputation just as a trustworthy partner, a caring and compassionate global power, that reputation is at stake. And as we discussed earlier, China is waiting to step right in to the vacuum that the U.S. leaves and win hearts and minds. So that's on the reputational side. On the national security side, the U.S. risks losing access to breaking information about pandemics, about food shortages. I mean, right now, the average American is worried about the price of eggs. If we're not doing work in agriculture around the world, we may not be prepared for some of these food shocks. And then, you know, what I find a bit ironic is that the Trump administration is very much against immigration, right? Close the borders, reduce immigration, kick out illegal immigrants. But the way I think about it, if we as Americans stop supporting vulnerable and marginalized groups, populations around the world, they will leave their home or their home countries or their places of current residence. And guess where they will try to come? Well, one place that they may try to come is America. So it could risk heightening demand for immigration.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that point. Another question on this. Listening to Secretary Rubio, it sounds at times like where this is maybe headed is to take the work that was being done by USAID and fold it into the State Department entirely. Is that something that you think might happen?
Oh, Grant, I'm not in the business of making predictions. I don't know what will happen, particularly under this administration. I think, you know, all of my friends who work for USAID have just been completely shocked. Nobody knows what's going to happen.
Let me frame it this way yeah. then, and I take your point. But let me frame it this way: could the work of USAID be folded into the State Department?
Well, now we're getting into issues of constitutionality, and I think we need a constitutional lawyer for this. You know, there's questions of what Congress will authorize. Congress actually authorizes USAID's annual budget. Has oversight over operations. So there's questions of what is constitutionally legal, what Congress will authorize. But you know, we've already seen this administration doing some things that seem questionable from a legal perspective. So I don't know.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and my guest is Syracuse University professor Catherine Harold. I think you maybe wanted, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to speak over you. I think you maybe wanted to have elaborated that last point. Go ahead if you want to add something.
Oh, I just wish I had an answer, but unfortunately, I think very few of us have answers to what will happen.
So I know you don't want to make predictions, and I respect that, but I'll go ahead and I guess make one and see if you have any comments about it. But I have to say, I don't understand this realm of government service as well as you do, but it's hard for me to believe that the United States is just going to scrap most of its foreign aid. I mean, I just can't wrap my mind around that, really. So I guess I still have this hunch that somehow this statement will be made, but there will be some reinstitution of the main parts of the foreign aid that we engage in. I do you have thought about that?
Well, I certainly hope you're right, Grant. However, you know, my friends around the world who work for both USAID and grant recipients of USAID funding, they are starting to shut down. Organizations are not able to sustain themselves without this aid. There are many non-governmental organizations that are local to target countries that rely very heavily or sometimes almost exclusively on USAID for their funding. If they can't survive these 90 days, they will shut down. And so my fear is that even if there's a walk back of some of this, some of the most blatant proposals, my fear is that the infrastructure will be gutted and there will be no place to send the aid.
I got you. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Well, I want to switch gears a little bit from what is happening right now with USAID and tap some of the research and your thoughts, a bigger picture about how we ought to think about foreign aid and the most effective ways to deliver it, because you've done research on that, you've written on that. So tell us more. You mentioned something about the local initiative, but tell us more about how, if you were restructuring it, what some of the changes you might make.
Sure, Grant. And I make these suggestions based on not only my time in USAID, but also my ethnographic research. And by ethnography, I mean I spend time, a lot of time, in the places that I study and become embedded in communities of non-governmental organizations, in civil society. And I hear directly from people working both in NGOs and in grassroots organizations around the world about what they need from aid, what their frustrations are, and what they need. So with that in mind, I really do believe in the international community's shift, or at least the West's shift, or let's say heightened emphasis on locally led development, on localizing foreign assistance. That means getting not only money, but also decision-making power and implementation power into the hands and voices of local actors. And I have some policy proposals for that, but then also some reforms to practice that I think could be helpful. So as I said, USAID operates missions around the world, but it's Washington that drives strategy. So can Washington, in driving USAID strategy, be a bit more responsive to local missions? Local missions, the leaders and staff of local missions indicate that they are in lockstep with Washington, but it's those staff who are most familiar with on-the-ground needs. So being more responsive to the priorities of local missions. I mentioned that USAID is very averse to risk. Can the agency try to be more risk tolerant? And in doing so, I would say walk the talk. USAID and state both have a history of cozying up to autocratic rulers. And I've had leaders of NGOs, of local NGOs in autocratic states, tell me that they feel like useful fools of USAID and of the international community when they side or when we side with dictators. So increasing a tolerance for risk and really standing by our values. And then considering flexible funding, and this would require Congress. But USAID, USAID's budget is, as I mentioned, a yearly allocation. That makes it really difficult for USAID to plan and for grantees to plan. So that's the policy side. And then on the practice side, you know, organizations express real frustration. Even the most professional local NGOs that I've talked to around the world say it is mission impossible to both manage USAID grants, which require complex application and reporting reforms, and also be responsible and embedded, or responsive to and embedded in local organizations. So can the agency, without decreasing its, you know, without being too risky, reform application and reporting requirements to make it easier for less professional, but deeply local organizations to apply. Also, there's something that USAID and development communities like to call capacity building. This is basically helping grant recipients deliver programs better and better conduct their operations. But too often, these capacity building programs that USAID funds are cookie cutter. So can the agency allow and invite local grant recipients to drive capacity building based on their unique needs? And then finally, I urge USAID to consider its own human resource management, to hire more staff in order to send more smaller grants to local organizations and to have more staff in the field understanding local problems, and then to incentivize staff to engage in locally led development rather than just sending multi-million dollar contracts to big international NGOs.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. One quick observation I'd make before we close is the recommendations that you are making would also require the government and us to be more tolerant sometimes that things might not work. You know, if you're going to be a little more risky, sometimes something might fail and we have to just, I think, better tolerate that. But those are really interesting points to end on. That was Catherine Harold. Professor Harold, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me. I learned a lot.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, conversations in the public interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher. The program is edited by Mark Livonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.